Welcome to Mystical Dispute, the limited Magic the Gathering debate podcast. I'm Garrett Gardner, a.k.a. G-Guards.
And I'm Carl Chase, a.k.a. 2Duck Cubed.
Check out our monthly bonus mini episodes on patreon.com/mysticaldispute, and thank you 1 billion trillion to our patrons. And today...
I would say 1 quadrillion. Boom, one up to you.
Every time. Today, we are going to debate the bad cards of the March of the Machine.
Garrett, there are... actually quite a few bad cards by definition being under a average game in hand win rate in this format, because there are a lot of really good rares, and so therefore a lot of commons that would otherwise be solid cards in other formats are not performing to an average standard.
Yeah, honestly, when we first started brainstorming for this podcast episode, notice I call it an episode.
Good one.
I know. I was like, Carl, are any cards below average? Isn't every card in this entire format above average?
I said, yes, Garrett, every single card is above average. That's how averages work.
But seriously, the card quality in this format is like across the board pretty good. Like even the cards that we're going to be talking about, or all the cards that look quote unquote bad, they are good. They would be good in a different format. But, you know, that's how averages work is what I learned. This is what my data friend taught me.
Yes, that all cards cannot be above average definitionally. I had a meme going on Twitter early in this format where I was playing decks. I first played a 41 card deck and I dedicated the 41st card to you when I won a trophy with it. And then I had a 42 card deck and I dedicated the 41st and 42nd card. Mm-hmm. And I went all the way up to, I think, 46 cards. And then I also did it for a 61st card with a Yorian deck. And like part of the reason that that actually worked and wasn't, it didn't totally torpedo me, is because there's a lot of just playables. You can load up your deck with playables. I mean, playing the Yorian decks in this format, for example, really isn't that hard because the cards are all, like you said, fairly reasonable. It's just the big issue comes when you're playing a solid common, like let's say a War Historian, 3 mana, 3/3 reach is like, oh, okay, that's a fine card. And then your opponent plays Atali and Sunfall and Chromehost Seed Shark and Zephyr Singer.
And Sheoldred and Chandra and Elish Norn and Matt.
And your 3 mana, 3/3 looks like an absolute dumbass.
And beyond that, this set introduced us to battles, and the battles to this day are underperforming as well. So that is, I think, contributing to the fact that the other cards are kind of pumped up in stats. There's not as many slots for real garbage in this format, especially because a couple of the battles, in my opinion, are that real garbage. And we already did an episode on battles, so I think we're safe to just exclude those from this bad cards episode.
We got plenty of other cards to talk about that are below the average of 54.7% game in hand win rate. So
let's go on to...
card one.
Garrett, card number one is my pet card for the format.
You've always got one.
One that I am very excited to talk about. And surprise, it is a one drop. And that is Aki Scrap Chomper. Your favorite casting cost and body type, the 1 mana 1/1. I know it's...
Yeah, that's what I'm known for, right?
Yep, you're the 1 mana 1/1 guy. And this one, its body is just not relevant on the battlefield all that often, because it's rare that a 1/1 is getting in for damage. But where the body is relevant is in Convoke, where every body is relevant and every card becomes a Llanowar Elves if it's a 1-drop. And 2 is the ability, which is pay 1 and a red, tap it, sacrifice an artifact or land to draw a card, which, while you're often not using it very early, can randomly draw you 2, 3, 4, 5 cards in a late game and allow you to outgrind the opponent should the game come down to that. But my main point here is about Convoke.
Sure.
When I am playing decks with Convoke, I am trying to go as all in as I possibly can. Because the bombs are so bomby in this format, I'm pretty much trying to build my decks in one of two ways. I want them to be linear, or I want them to be full of bombs, or even better, both. But one way that you can get around people playing cards like Atali and Breach the Multiverse is to do a ton of stuff in turns 3 through 5. And getting out on turn 1 for Convoke just means every single one of your Convoke spells is going to be one less for the rest of the game. And so you play Aki's Crap Jumper on turn 1, you play Ral's Reinforcements on turn 2, and all of a sudden on turn 3 you have you know, quote unquote, six mana that you can now, maybe you play the 3/4 flyer, maybe you're holding up Artistic Refusal, maybe you are actually playing another two drop, another one drop, and then playing Temporal Cleansing on that turn and are just able to have huge turns like really early in the game.
And for reference, the Aki Boy has 52.9%, which is fairly below that 54.7% average, but a little bit higher than I would expect. But let me just push back on one thing, Carl, is you say it's good in Convoke, but in my experience in this format, red doesn't Convoke a lot in itself. I'm looking at all the red Convoke spells, and we've got Stoke the Flames, of course, always. City on Fire, I could see. But then on the other end, we've got Burning Sun's Fury, which might be the worst card in the format, in my opinion. And Shivan Branch Burner, which I don't think quite gets there, the 4/4 Flying Haste for 7. So I imagine you're pairing this pretty often in blue decks, is that right?
Yeah, it is certainly at its best in blue-red decks. You are also going to have more artifacts in blue-red decks as well, so you can get random value by not sacking a land, but sacking a treasure or whatever other artifact that you've got in the blue-red deck. But Stoke the Flames is a big reason to be in red.
Sure.
Because it's
real good?
Yeah, it's real good. I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to say it's the best red uncommon. I guess I don't have the stats up in front of me. But I mean, I love it. And it is super abusable and really good. And just being able to hold up a 4 damage spell when you're, end quote, tapped out is unbelievable.
Sure.
But yes, blue-red is great. Typically, the trio of cards that I'm looking to pair together in the red decks are the Aki Scrap Chomper, the Beamtown Beatstick, which pairs well with Aki Scrap Chomper because you can attack early and get treasures because you got a one drop, and also it can eat the treasures to draw more cards in the late game, which is great. And Rael's Reinforcements, which actually pairs well with both of those cards. You say, well, how does Aki Scrap Chomper and Rael's Reinforcements pair well together? Well, they enable the Convoke like crazy because you can get up to 3 creatures on turn 3.
Sure.
And Rael's Reinforcements, again, great with Beamtown Beatstick because once you have a menace creature and they have to start like double blocking creatures to stop you from getting in for your treasures, now all of a sudden your little 2/1 menace with the Beatstick on the 1/1 token is often just getting in no problem. So those three cards together form a very, very good battery that pairs especially well with blue. Pairing it with Meeting of the Minds, Temporal Cleansing, City on Fire is definitely one that I'm always looking to combo around, because if you can go all in on that card, I mean, first of all, you're turning all your 1/1s into 3 power creatures.
Sure.
And then, you know, you're still the Flames deals 12, and you can just go completely off with that card. But you can't play City of Fire in any random deck because it will just be it'll be a literal blank in most decks. So you have to be super duper linear to make that card work. That's the battery. So my stats really show that. Over the last 3 weeks, I'm going to read you my 6 most drafted cards. Flywheel Racer is number 1 because I always just pick that up late in case I get a bomb in Pack 2 or Pack 3.
Okay.
Halo Hopper, because if I get it all in Convoke deck, then it can be pretty decent, although I cut it a lot. Marauding Dreadship, and the next 3, Beamtown Beatstick, Rael's Reinforcements, and Aki Scrap Chamber. So there is that battery. And it is one of the few ways that I've found to create some sort of a linear consistency that can beat bombs. So, Garrett, you always talk about fail cases and that you don't like fail cases. And does it have fail cases? Absolutely. Sometimes you're sitting there with a bunch of 1/1s that are doing nothing. But if you can build around those, you can do some powerful things.
Yeah, I can definitely see how you can leverage this card in some circumstances, but I'm just still so skeptical of having it, you know, come out in the middle of a turn 4 or something like that. It's your top deck, and it just feels like so awkward. I have been on the other side of it when my opponent was just eating their lands after flooding and kind of getting back into the game. Totally legit way to use the card, but I always wonder, like, is that 1 mana 1/1 was just something relevant for the board? Would they even be in that situation to begin with?
Yeah, and if Convoke did not exist in this format, I don't think this card would be playable. It's the fact that it accelerates you early and then, as a side benefit, can draw you 3 or 4 cards in the late game in if you get to a standstill. That's, to me, really where the combination plays out, and the fact that you've got Beamtown Beatstick in the format and just having a 1-drop is great with that as well. So it's contextual. I mean, I think the reason that this card's stats are bad is because, again, if you just put it in a random deck that doesn't have Beatsticks, doesn't have a lot of Convoke, it's just not very good. So it is exactly the fail case that you were mentioning.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Shall we move to
Card 2.
What do you got to bring to us, Garrett?
My pet bad card, and it's pretty bad, at a 52.8%. Actually, the worst on our list, and a little worse than Aki Boy. It's Wildwood Escort. The 4 and a green for a 3/3 when it enters the battlefield. You grave dig for a creature or a battle from your graveyard. But if it dies, exile it instead.
Can you believe this card's 52.8%, Garrett? I know you can't.
No, I can't. I mean, I saw this card and I was like, this is like my card. This is what I like to do. And you will make fun of me, I guess, because it kind of is just a vanilla 3/3, but it's attrition, right? It's card advantage on a body. That's how I like to play my games of Magic. And this comes down, you know, it's a little overcosted for a 3/3 body, but if you can get something back from your graveyard that's relevant, you know, you can play your game around it and trade something early, especially with bodies that can transform later. I felt like this card was going to be quite good, and instead, it's actually quite bad. And I guess I'm not here to sing its praises because I don't play a lot of these. I am not terribly excited to play them, but I do think that it's wrong to write them off completely.
So, Garrett, for all of these cards we're talking about, there's a reason why we think they have spots in your decks at times, and there's a reason why their stats are bad. So,
sure.
Can you help me? Like, what do you think it takes to make Wildwood Escort a good card?
Well, we've been talking about it, and I think it's sort of the defining aspect of this format, but it's bombs, right? Like, if you have a creature body bomb, which most of the bombs in this format are, they're not spells, they're like Shieldred or Elesh Norn or Elesh Norn the other one, you know, like if you have one of those types of creatures in your deck, this can buy it back, and it's like you've got two copies of it. Where I've been playing this card a lot is in green-black because of the self-mill strategy. Because obviously, if you can fill up your graveyard, this starts to look more and more like a demonic tutor, right? Like, if you can mill yourself three and one of them ends up being your super-duper extremely great Itali bomb that you're splashing for, or if you're in black, like a Shieldred, which I have done many times, buying it back is worth, I don't know, four cards, right? Like, that's sort of how this format plays out for me, is like, these bombs feel like they're like 4-for-1s. And if you can escort, which is kind of like a, I don't know, 1.7-for-1, and get back that 4-for-1, then you're in a really great spot. The other place I like it is that I end up playing a lot of those land cyclers in my decks. I like to have like one or two, and I know others are a little lower on them, but I think they're very serviceable, like 7 drops, and they can help your mana out. And I just find it nice to basically guarantee that the escort can bring back like a giant body. Like, you're gonna cycle it early if you have time, and worst case scenario, you've got your 5/5 menace that backups 2, or you've got a 6/5 reach. Those are relevant bodies that can close out a game. So while I don't play escort a lot, I do think it's worth considering when you're doing self-mill, when you've got those land cyclers and you just need some bodies to fill up the end game, but especially if you've got those major creature bombs.
My only pushback on that one, and honestly, it's almost more of a pushback on the land cyclers than it is anything else. I thought those cards were just going to be fantastic and I'd want them in every deck. But the way that things have played out is if you've got an opponent building a board again and doing convoke things or ramping into bombs or whatever it might be, and you're spending 2 mana to land cycle and then a 5 mana 3/3 to get your land cycler back, you just haven't spent enough mana on the board on relevant turns. It's a fine fail case. It's absolutely a fine fail case. And I'm not saying I haven't done that plenty of times, but it's not like you're not building a deck to do that. That's a thing that you can do deck.
You're not like excited to play the land cyclers and then you're like, oh, I'll put escort in my deck. But it is a nice fail case, right? You can have that land cycler to make sure you can get to your 7-drop Itali or whatever it is that you need. Like, that's where I find I play those land cyclers is when I have like really powerful top end, and I just sometimes you're land cycling on turn 5 just to make sure you can get your 6th land to play a 6-drop or a 7-drop or something like that. And I feel like escort can kind of back up that strategy, but I don't think it's a winning strategy at all, and it's reflected in the win rate to actively want to do that.
If you've ever had an opponent just do nothing and then cycle a land at the end of their turn when they have 6 mana available, you say, oh crap.
what is coming? And it's always something horrific.
What is about to just bash my face in next turn? Because that 7 drop slot is real scary in this format. The other pushback that I'd have on this one, Garrett, is this is not a format that I really want to grind in. Because inevitably, Elishnorn or Breach the Multiverse or Atali or Chandra or whatever, keep talking about this forever, or a flipped Praetor that just, you know, like... kills 7 things,
yeah.
Mill 47.
You win the next 7 games in your draft automatically, etc. Yeah.
Put 49 tokens on the battlefield. I don't know. They do crazy things. Compare this to Midnight Hunt. If you go back to that format, you could grind like crazy in that format. The removal was great. There were really good rares, but nothing that, like, you had flipped the switch and you had good removal so you could deal with the rares. And so once you had those cards that could deal with the bombs, you could just play Organ Hoarders and get them back, and you could search Party Captains and the Spirits and Disturb, and, like, you could just grind forever and ever and ever. And you just can't do that in March of the Machines unless you have a thing that you're grinding towards, or unless you've got extremely, extremely good control package. And I mean extremely good, because usually people have a way to get their bombs back. If they're playing 2 or 3 great creature rares, they probably have Unsealing the Necropolis in their deck. And so if you got a plan and you've got bombs yourself, yeah, grinding can work. If you don't, you have to be faster than that. And I think that's the main reason that, you know, this card that would be really, really good. Like, again, you put this in Midnight Hunt, for example, and this card would
be fantastic.
Fantastic in that format. And it's just kind of, you got to be selective. Here. If your top end is Converter Beast, this card's probably not good enough.
You know, it's interesting, Carl, because I was going to push back on you for the Aki Scrap Chomper, because that's a grindy card too, right? But it's a grindy card on an irrelevant body. But you did make the point in that one, and I will give it to you, that you're primarily playing that for Convoke, and you're certainly not playing a 5-mana 3/3 for Convoke. So it does make sense to me why the Wildwood Escort is just not making it.
Listen, I've made the joke before that there are decks where you would play Merfolk of the Pearl Trident or Mons Goblin Raiders. I really do think that there are decks where you would play those cards in this format. Like, not ideal, but if you've built the deck with a lot of Convoke things and all of a sudden you just don't have any one drops, like, yeah, get that Mons Goblin Raider in there. And so, yes, it's got to have the dual purpose there.
Yeah.
But, Garrett, I totally hear your point, especially with Galissa and with Shield are some of the cards that really come to mind with Wildwood Escort, because Shieldred necessarily is going to slow the game down and it threatens a big thing, so they have to kill it. They have to kill Shieldred at some point. And once they do that and you get it back, I mean, that is a winning strategy, absolutely. And then Glissa, usually you can create some sort of value off the Glissa, so you got the Incubate tokens again, you can chump a little bit, and then it's a Lightning Rod, so they're going to try to kill it, and then you can get it back, and it's great there too.
And don't forget, this card doesn't just get creatures, it also gets battles.
Yeah.
And if you've got a bomb of a battle, like Innistrad or Amonkhet or
Fiora,
or I don't know, even Invasion of New Phyrexia on the splash, like if you can get that, or you milled it, right? You can get that back. Like, I think it's worth it. I think this card is definitely not something you should just completely ignore. Like, it doesn't go super early, and I think it can make your deck with those sorts of decks where you have, like, a handful of fantastic bombs and maybe shaky mana.
And again, to your point on green-black, specifically Fiora and Innistrad are great with it, because Innistrad is going to go to the yard when you flip it, and so that's great. And then Fiora necessarily allows you to deal with opposing bombs. So because you have the card that deals with opposing bombs, and you've played the card that deals with opposing bombs, and then you flipped it into a must-kill threat, and they have to kill it, that is the perfect situation for Wildwood Escort.
Don't sleep on my 5-mana 3/3s, baby.
See, Snid Lover. We're going to add that to your 2-mana 2/2 fetish.
To my repertoire? Yeah, all right. Let's go on to...
Can I say fetish? Is that a thing I could say in the pod? I don't know.
You can now. It's our pod. That's what we say.
Card 3.
All right. I just gave you crap, Garrett.
You did.
For talking about 2-mana 2/2s.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. You know what my card 3 is?
Surprise me.
Alabaster Host Sanctifier, which is a whole lot of letters and words to say it's a 2-mana 2/2 lifelink.
Carl, I feel like every format, you gush over the 2-mana white common 2/2 lifelink. And then in the same breath, you come back at me and you say, oh, Gary, he loves 2-minute 2/2s. He's so boring. It's so vanilla. This is your pet card. Every time you're like, oh my God, what was the first one called again, Carl?
Story Seeker?
Yeah, Story Seeker. That's it. I couldn't think of it because you haunted my dreams talking Story Seeker. It was the best. It was the best. That was like right when we first started talking is when Kaldheim came out and you were just like, Story Seeker is the truth. So tell me, Carl, why is this card that's sitting at a 53%, that's 1.7 points below average, so great in this format?
So Garrett, just like with the other bad cards, there's a reason that it has poor stats. And that's because most of the two drops in this format also do something else, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They transform into a more powerful threat. Maybe they're doing some sort of backup thing. There's a 2-mana 3/3 in green. It's just a straight up 2-mana 3. I mean, it's actually technically a 0/2, but it's got the backup and it deals damage according to its toughness. So it's basically 2-mana 3/3. And so again, if you just put this card in your deck, I mean, it's just kind of sitting there. It's just often not good enough. So where do I like this card?
Yeah, please tell me.
This card, again, to me, is a linear strategy enabler and a bomb enabler. Hey, back to that same theme yet again.
Sure, sure.
So one spot that I really like this card is when you have a ton of ways to pump up power on the creature. In particular, one spot that I found it really good is in Rayav decks. That's the red white 2-drop uncommon that when a equipped creature attacks, it gets double strike.
Ah, yes.
And it's a fantastic body in that deck. First of all, you're going to have tons of equipment in that deck. And so even if you don't draw Rayav, like those are ways to pump Story Seeker and get more value out of. The thing about Lifelink is that essentially it quote unquote doubles the buffs to it, right? Because you're both gaining a life and you're dealing the damage. But then when you have Rayav out, think about a Beamtown Beatstick on Story Seeker, on an Alabaster Host, whatever the hell it is.
It's Story Seeker in your heart, I can tell.
Yeah, we're just gonna, I'm just calling it Story Seeker Mom. It's Story Seeker and Mom.
Yeah, okay, that didn't work great, but I'll let it pass.
It's a real D-minus joke. So you're getting 2 treasures, you're gaining 6 life, and that could not be a better Atali enabler. And so, like, that shell with Atali is, I've done that multiple times, actually. It sounds crazy. Like, yeah, it's 4 different cards you just mentioned there. Yeah, well, somewhat of a build around. The other spot that it's really good, and I think very, very underplayed in, is if you are in a heavy backup deck and +1/+1 counter deck.
You know,
maybe you've got Ozolith, the shared spire that can put 2+1/+1 counters every single turn. Maybe you just have a ton of different backup creatures. Maybe you're playing Fertilid's Favor in that deck. Who knows? Anytime where you've just got a lot of ways to pump something, it is a fantastic creature to pump. And you got to be a little bit careful, because if you don't have bombs in your deck, again, like, you can gain all the life you want and make a 4/4 or a 5/5 lifelink and then just get blown out of the water by Chandra. So you can't rely on it too much. But if you've got enough, again, linear powerful strategy, for example, in decks that have a lot of the Phyrexian synergies in them.
Sure.
So all of the enchantments that makes incubator tokens and then grants abilities to the incubator tokens. You've got the 2 white and a black uncommon that gives all Phyrexians +1/+1.
And for the record, it is a Phyrexian.
Yes, and it, you're right. The creature type is Phyrexian. So it works well with those as well. But really what it does is to all the incubator cards are slow, right?
Mm-hmm.
You make a thing and then you've got to spend 2 more mana to activate the thing. And so Alabaster Host Sanctifier grants you the time that you need to spend the mana to get all of the crazy value you can get off of the incubator token, and really allows you time to get that synergy together, right? Because
it synergizes
so well, but you've got to have multiple cards in play and spend the 2 mana to activate. And like, there's a lot you have to do. So it gives you the time to do those things.
And to be clear, you're saying it gives you this time because lifelink gains you life and it just prolongs games, right?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know why you did this to me. You're putting me on the anti for a 2-mana 2/2 with upside, Carl. This is really probably the worst thing you've ever done to me.
You should see the grin I have in my face right now.
Joking aside, I don't really love this card. And the main reason is because it doesn't say Knight on it. And often where I want to play this card, I feel like where I want to just curve out and beat down with a tempo deck with a lifelink, especially, is in the Knight's deck. And it feels like it's really at ends with that, because you're not playing a creature with that Knight subtype. Like, I found myself at the end in the deck building being like, oh man, let's get this 2-mana 2/2 in, we'll just curve out. And it not being a Knight is definitely a downside to this card. But I think if it had been a knight, we would have not be talking about it in the bad cards section.
You really don't want to play it in the knight's deck. It's crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, it feels like it should be in there, and then you don't want it in that deck.
And that very much could be why it's got such a bad win rate, right? People are looking at this card and they're like, 2-mana, 2-2, curve out, beat down, tempo, and it's just not really good at that. And specifically because you pointed out that there's all these other 2-drops in the format that transform into bigger things, or can pump, or can come with some additional value. And the additional value here is lifelink, which if you're doing beatdown stuff, doesn't really matter that much.
Yep.
So I guess in the end, Carl, your argument is it's a bit more defensive.
It's a bit more defensive. It's like almost a combo card in a weird way. It combos with bombs, or it combos with other synergy stuff.
Yeah, I could see that, but I don't end up playing this card terribly often, because when I'm white, I feel like I want to beat down most of the time.
And that's, I mean, like we said, I'll repeat it again. With these cards, you got to know when to cut them. Probably want to cut it from your knight's deck. You probably want to cut it in a deck where, again, you don't have a lot of top end, or you don't have a lot of pump. If you don't have those things, probably you shouldn't play the card.
I do joke that I love 2-mana 2-2s, but 2-mana 2-2s without upside are bad, I think. So you've got to have a reason, like any other card.
You know, like Tavern Swindler, the upside of... zero life.
100 years later, you're going to tell me I said that card was good when I didn't ever say it was good. All right, let's move on.
I'm pretty sure that's not correct. Let's keep going.
Card 4.
Garrett, we talked about 2-drops that do other big things. I know that you have the softest of spot in your hearts for 2-drops that have value in the late game.
Oh, yeah.
I know you're chomping at the bit to talk about this one, so... let's go.
Well, we talked about a 1-mana 1-1. We talked about a 2-mana 2-2. But Carl, can I interest you in a 2-mana 1-1 in Aetherblade Agent, which is 1 of black for a 1-1 Death Touch with 4 and a Phyrexian blue, to transform it into a 3-3 that you get to draw a card whenever it does combat damage to a player or battle? Simply put, Carl, I love this card. I probably love this card too much. So far, we've talked about 3 cards that it's like, maybe sometimes you want to play this card. Usually you want to cut it, or you want specific circumstances. I feel like the opposite with Agent. I feel like I want as many as I can get, and I will never cut this card because I feel like it plays so well in this format. And I was shocked, absolutely shocked, to see that it came in below average at 54.5% win rate. Pretty close to average, but still below average. Whereas, I mean, the black removal, I could see taking over it, but sometimes I end up taking Agent over black removal spells because I just feel like it plays exactly like how I like to play Magic. Beyond that, Death Touch is a magical word that can deal with bombs. In this format, I know a lot of the super bombs like Atali, like the reason that they're good isn't because they're gigantic, right? It's because they come with a bunch of other effects, but this is only 2-mana and it can trade with your opponent's 8-8 or whatever ends up on their board. Or if they're able to flip a battle into a creature and you really need to get rid of that flipped creature, Death Touch can deal with that. So already we're working with something that I think works well in the context of this format. And Carl, I see you waving at me, just desperately trying to get my attention, but I'm just so excited that I just keep talking. Okay, fine. Make your point.
I can't help myself in this one. I cannot help myself this one. So you just said it could deal with bombs because of the word Death Touch. So I just wanted to read from kind of the highest game in hand win rate down on the bombs. And we could talk about how Aetherblade Agent matches up against those cards. All right. Elesh Norn, Grand Cenobite. Okay, well, maybe if it's flipped, that's still on the board afterwards. Sunfall, you know, you get in for like at least 2 or 3 damage before they wrath your board and get a 7-7, so that's good. Breach the Multiverse, you can block one of their massive creatures that, assuming you have cards left in your library. Chrome Host Seed Shark, really good against that card. I don't know how. Boonbringer Valkyrie, again, a great example where it's still on the battlefield after they play the card and gain like 10 life and kill you in the air. Chandra, yeah, again, you get in it for like 2 or 3 damage before Chandra kills it for only 1 loyalty. And Shieldred, it's a card that you can sack to Shieldred. Zephyr Singer. Zephyr, again, it holds back those creatures for a while until they play the Zephyr Singer, and then they all fly over the Aetherblade Agent. It can hold off Glissa from attacking for 3 after they have, like, 30 incubator tokens.
All right, all right. I get it, Carl. I mean, we've said it about 15 times in this episode so far. All of these bombs are nearly unbeatable. They come down and they are 3-for-1s the turn they get played. And no common, even straight up removal, can deal with a lot of this stuff because it just comes with free value. So I'm not really judging the 2-mana 1/1 Death Touch on that, but I do think that having flipped it and attacking into your opponent's bomb may put them in a perilous situation where they're forced to block with whatever, because you can't just like let your opponent draw free cards. And so that's where I think this agent can come into play. You're right, though. I concede the point that there's so many cards in this format that this doesn't answer, but that's sort of this format, right? The commons are incredibly, incredibly powerful and standalone must answer threats. In any other format, they would be probably too powerful, but because of the not just power level of the bombs, but also that extra slot for the legends, there's a lot more bombs lying around. So like, I don't think any common is going to really answer that sort of thing, but the agent can kind of do it. It's my only point in that it can trade with the body. It buys you time. And also like, they have to be constantly thinking you can just flip it and attack and then get that card of value. And they may not want to trade whatever creatures on their battlefield, but sometimes they have to.
You know what it's really good against too is some of the linear common strategies, right? Because you're building huge creatures with like backup, your 5/5 incubator tokens. It's all very solid against those strategies as well.
Plus there's a couple green fight spells that you can pair with this, and then it just turns those spells into removal for anything. But mostly though, what I like about this card is you can put it down on 2 and it will trade with whatever your opponent is attacking you with. And like you said, there's big vanilla creatures, but there's also flip creatures on your opponent's side. Like, you know what Aetherblade Agent works really good against? A flipped Aetherblade Agent. You know, they've invested 6 mana in this card and 2 life, and then they have to attack into your 2 mana only. So where I like to leverage Agent is you are probably trading it, I don't know, with something a little bit costlier 70% of the time or more. But then when you're in that special board state where you can afford to flip it and attack, you can just go off. And that's where I like the agent. And I guess I'm not super shocked by its unimpressive win rate for the reasons you explained, right? It can't deal with a lot of things, but it also feels like a card that's easy to misplay. Like if you spend the 4 mana and 2 life to flip this and you attack into your opponent who has 1 untapped island, that's a disaster because they're going to dispersal you. You're going to get wrecked. And you need to know to play around that sort of thing. And a lot of the time with cards like this, it's so enticing to flip and get that life in that it's easy to protect it too much and not just trade it off for a 3-drop. You know, honestly, like if you play an agent, it's a 2-mana card and it trades for a 3-drop, you're ahead on that board. And that's where I like to play the agent, and it just plays well with my attrition style decks. But like you said earlier, those decks are not always the best to go into in this format because you're sort of wasting time generating small amounts of value until whatever bomb comes down and defines the game. Still, I think Agent is both a great defensive card that can really pull its weight if you can flip it and make profitable attacks to either draw a card or force them to trade a bigger creature.
It also makes battle math a lot more challenging as well, because people want to flip their battles, and so they're going to want to attack, and having an Aetherblade Agent can make that combat a lot more difficult and usually force you to trade one of the better creatures on your board if you want to flip the battle. Definitely pairs well with Unsealed and Acropolis. Even with cards like Invasion of Amonkhet, you say, well, it's, you know, it's only one power to go attack the Invasion of Amonkhet, but Invasion of Amonkhet isn't a fast card. I mean, it doesn't affect the board the turn it comes into play, but if you can get that thing flipped, obviously, then you can turn into a really good creature. And so buying yourself some time, playing the Invasion of Amonkhet, accruing the value, you probably have Unsealed and Acropolis in that deck as well. Now you're milling a bunch of cards into both graveyards, giving a bunch of other targets for Invasion of Amonkhet. And at that point, so maybe you've been able to trade off for a few relevant creatures, you put them back in the battlefield, you flip it, and now you've got something to deal with, and that kind of all works well together.
Unseal the Necropolis is probably my favorite card to pair with this card because you're spending 3 mana to not affect the board. So playing a cheap 2-drop that can trade with an 8/8 is a good way to make sure you got your value out of that. And then, of course, if you can also Gravedig one and then flip it to a 3-3 must deal with threat. That's also pretty cool. I don't know. I you went hard. You're correct. It doesn't beat the bombs, Carl. I was just trying to live in some kind of magical Christmas land where it was at least going a bit toe-to-toe with them, but you're right. It's not going to beat bombs, but I still think that, like, in the bad cards category is not where I would put this card. I really, really like it. I think it's my second favorite or third favorite black common.
So, Garrett, while I agree with all those points, and I think you made a great case for the exact times you want to use the card, you still have to be careful, because ultimately, it's two mana, it's one power, and if it is not part of a broader plan, that is simply not good enough, because you can't just wait around and say, you know what, I'm just going to wait. I mean, Death Touch in and of itself is essentially saying, you know what, I'm going to let my opponent come at me, and then I'm going to deal with it when they're coming at me. And this is not the format for just doing that. So it has to be part of a broader plan to make the card as good as you want it. I mean, is it going to kill you to put it in a random deck? Probably not. Again, I mean, you can block something, and you can flip it and maybe draw a card off of it. Like, yeah, but you want it to be just like every single card in Limited. I mean, this is literally every card in Limited. I mean, I say this over and over again, but you want this to be part of a plan.
Sure.
And, you know, if we went a little further down that list, the next card is Vorinclex. So you can trade with Vorinclex after they get two forests and you take five. So that's at least, that kind of deals with it. It's
honestly, I was desperately looking through to be like, I found one. And I'm like, oh, Ancient Imperiosaur. All you have to do is take 11 damage and you trade with it. I mean, like, listen, I probably shouldn't have said it does anything to the bombs in this format, but in a normal format, it probably would do something to the bombs.
Anyway,
let's wrap all this up, Carl, in
closing arguments.
Garrett, this bad card episodes was a thinly veiled disguise for us to complain about bombs for an entire podcast episode.
Mission accomplished.
Yes. But jokes aside, I mean, I do think that the main thesis point here that we just hammered into the ground, to me, is the main thought you need to have when drafting in this format is, you know that there are super powerful cards are out there. So what is your plan? Because almost every opponent is going to have that, or they're going to have some crazy linear aggro deck. One of those two things is going
to
be true.
Yeah, I mean, Carl and I love complaining about bombs. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's important to recognize when a format is really bomb heavy like this one, especially like this one. Because, I mean, even if it was the same number of powerful bombs as a normal format, this set, because of that extra Multiverse Legends slot, it basically has a rare and a half in every pack or more. It's like 1.7 or something like that, right? So with that in mind, like, it's going to change the way that the format plays out. And so these commons that we listed out, I mean, they don't feel like they should be bad cards, but they're all below average. And so I think that just says something about the way that the format plays out and the way that you have to build around these cards. And if you're just jumping in, maybe for the first time playing this format, you might be in for a shock for how powerful they ended up being.
It's why cards like Assimilate Essence have performed so well. I mean, 57.9% for a card that is, I mean, just objectively worse than Essence Scatter. It's crazy, right? But
yeah.
When you're spending two mana to counter an Atali, yeah, that's pretty darn good. So, Garrett, to your point, while there's a lot, there's just a high volume of quote-unquote playable cards, you can't just have a deck full of cards. You can't just have a deck full of, like, nice commons. Maybe if you, it's not really gonna be where you want to be. They gotta come together to do a thing.
Yeah, I think that's true in general, but it's extra true in a format like this. You gotta have, like, a very cohesive plan, and you have to recognize that the power level of the card might not be what it looks like in a vacuum.
Absolutely.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna go kill some bombs with my 2-mana 1/1 Death Touch.
And I am going to go stare Chrome Host Seed Shark in the face with my 2-mana 2/2 lifelink.
Well, that about wraps it up. So thanks for listening to Mystical Dispute. You can support the show on Patreon. I'm Garrett Gardner. You can find me at twitch.tv/gguards.
And I'm Carl Chase. You can find me on Twitter at 2DuckCubed.
Shout out to 17 Lands with the Data, especially this episode, but, you know, all of them forever. Please go support them on Patreon. Please, please, please. And until next time, stay chill.
Adios.
You know, it's interesting, Carl, because I was going to push back on you for the Aki script. Oh my God, I can't say it. For the like, this is why I kept coming up with nicknames for it. I can't say it.
Aki boy. Just say Aki boy.
Yeah, all right.
B-O-I.